Hey, Snapper. We've got an amazing Snap special program for you. We're calling it the Student and the Teacher. But first, I want to give you a Snap Judgment campaign update. We've only got 11 more days till Friday the 13th, and I roll into a big meeting with the powers that be, and they're going to want to know who's got your back. And so far, we're almost at the halfway mark. 2,311 Snappers have stepped up. But to keep your show popping, 5,000 Snappers have to answer the call to support Snap Storytelling at snapjudgment.org. So please, answer the call. And for just $7 a month, we're going to pull back the curtain and give you a virtual window into a Snap Story session. See how this program gets made. Help us decide what goes in and what stays out. It's your show. Help us make it. For $10 a month, I'm going to give a session on telling the story you were born to tell. Because you have a story, and I get to help you tell it the way you want to tell it. So pause the program. Pause it for just a moment. Go to snapjudgment.org. $2 a month, $2,000, whatever it's worth to you. Snapjudgment.org. Okay, Snappers, welcome to the Student and the Teacher Snap Special. You'll see what I'm getting at in just a minute with this, but first, I want to give you the backstory on one of our most iconic pieces ever. So we're getting ready for a big live show. We've gone through several submissions, and I've just finalized the lineup. And I want Jamie DeWolf to be in this show, but his story is just not working. So I have to call him and give him the bad news. I call him, "Sorry, brother, but we'll work you into the next one." And Jamie's like, "Forget that piece. I've got a whole new idea, a story I've never really told." Jamie, there's not time to get something new together. The show's this weekend. Just check your email. Keep checking your email. Click. All right. I move on to other things, and I get his email. And it reads like newfound scripture. I call him back, dude. Un-be-fucking-leavable. But we just have a few days. Can you get this done in time? And Jamie's like, "This is the story I was born to tell." And then he warns me. He's like, "I really, really, really want to do this, but I don't want to put you in any jeopardy. This is dangerous." And I get that, but I still didn't feel like we had a choice.
Mr.
Jamie DeWolf.
Every family has their black sheep. On my mother's side, our black sheep was a shepherd who enslaved his own flock. The king of the Khans, a man who made himself a messiah, even though he never called himself a god. Even tonight, his words are written in steel and titanium capsules in a nuclear-reinforced bunker miles underground. So if our whole species goes extinct, his words will still survive. He was a subject we never talked about at the kids' table at family reunions, but he was my great-grandfather, L. Ron Hubbard. Lafayette Ron Hubbard. He was born a storyteller, a science fiction writer, a golden-tongued grifter who could write a book in any genre while the publisher waited downstairs in the hotel lobby. Just another name on dime store pulp mags, paid only a penny a page until 1949 when he said, "You want to know how you really get rich? You start a religion." A year later, he kept to his word, wrote Dianetics, transforming science fiction into fact, until you could pay to flatline your mind for a fee. Overnight, he went from pennies to a profit, until the world demanded to see his evidence. But L. Ron knew if you don't have facts, all you need is faith. So he turned his science into a religion, and Scientology was born. A few years later, his son arrives, a baby who had survived an early abortion attempt, born premature at 2 pounds, 2 ounces, abandoned by his father as he sought fame and fortune. Now he emerged to take his part of the new family business. He was my grandfather, L. Ron Hubbard Jr. Carrying his father's name and his red hair, Jr. became his right-hand man and was a devout disciple and a believer, helping him to construct the church, and it took him years to realize he was only another accomplice. Trained in the arts of electrified hypnotism, blackmail, and beatdowns, he learned to hide his crimes behind his charisma, and it took him a decade to see the holes behind the holy, the man behind the myth, his father. Stuffing thousands of dollars in a shoebox he kept secret underneath the bed, his father. Burning incriminating documents before dawn, his father. Escaping criminal charges as he ran from state to state as Junior watched his family and friends' brains washed, banks broken. Sickened by what he had seen behind the curtain, in 1959, Junior left. But his father always understood retribution better than redemption, and he stalked his son with wiretaps, break-ins, and death threats. My grandfather coming home to photographs of his children in his mailbox, playing on playgrounds, alone and unguarded, to remind him the eye of the pyramid never blinks. While every one of my aunts and uncles were taught how to use a gun, the son, forced to live like his dad, permanently on the run until he changed his last name from Hubbard to DeWolf. A lie to protect him from ever having to tell the truth. When your father has created a religion in your lifetime, there's no son big enough to ever escape his shadow. But there's a thin line between prophecy and psychosis, and the barefaced messiah ran from countries and criminal charges, an international outlaw on a ship, escaping extradition, his sanity slipping as he started confusing his past from his fiction, until one day he vanished before a courtroom or a jail cell could ever make him real again. Junior, now buried under debt, tried to flush his father out of hiding to write him a check. So he litigated the Holy Ghost to prove he still had flesh. The son took his war public to scrape the idol's gold down to rust. Junior, now a dying diabetic with an amputated foot, buried and battered from a decade of lawsuits against the man who carried his same name. Until the day his dad died in hiding, cremated the next morning, leaving only a legacy of ashes. The church gave the son one final offer. Arrest your tongue, swallow the truth for one final check, or you and your next of kin will face a lifetime of threats. So he signed away his silence and took his secrets and 2 heart attacks to his grave. Another victim the church stopped pretending to save. On Thanksgiving, in a house a self-made God paid for, his great-grandchildren never said his name. He was the one God we never gave grace to. One day, my grandfather led me to a bookshelf and showed me volumes of his father's works, and he said, "Your mom says you want to be a writer. Well, don't believe everything you read, but believe everything you say." I never met the man who gave me my red hair, the manic depression still twisted in the strains of my DNA. And the first time I saw a psychiatrist, when he asked me if mental illness runs in my family, all I could say was, "Yes. Yes, it does." When I told him my great-grandfather was a cult leader that enslaved the minds of millions, he accused me of having delusions of grandeur. What can I say? It runs in my veins. I've been in secret to L. Ron Hubbard Hollywood life exhibits where his latest victim leads me on a tour of a life he never led. My family written out of existence. And this disciple will never know the legacy of lies that I still carry in my last name. The Wolf, a cover story to protect us from my great-grandfather's true children, the army of empty, who greet me in train stations with an e-meter and a personality test, and they ask me if I've ever heard of L. Ron Hubbard. And I want to ask them, which one? The son or the father? The god or the man?
The amazing Jamie the Wolf, creator of Tourette's Without Regrets and other stuff, coming soon. I am not yet at liberty to discuss, but keep your eye on the DeWolf. The Snap Band, Alex Mandel, David Brant, and Tim Frick. Now, ripples from that performance are still being felt. Super proud. And shortly after Jamie created the God and the Man piece, I rolled up into the Snap offices, and it's the usual bedlam, but in the middle sits this kid. Jamie DeWolf is introducing him around. This kid's like, "Hi, I'm Noah." Oh, Noah St. John, and I'd heard of him because he just won a Grand Slam poetry final. And Jamie DeWolf had been mentoring him on slam poetry through this group called Youth Speaks. And Noah says, "I've got a poem that might make a good story." And I'm like, "Well, you know what, kid? That's not generally how it works. But if Jamie brought you in here, talk to the Uber producer. And yeah, I'll give it a look too." Well, this kid is made of magic. So a few days later, I ask his parents if it's okay for Noah to join us for a live show in Washington, D.C. They say cool, just as long as Jamie DeWolf, his mentor, will chaperone.
Now, I have asked all the storytellers tonight to dig deep. Next on the Snap Judgment stage, I am so excited. First time ever on the Snap stage, but he is only 15 years old. Please put your hands together for Mr. Noah St. John.
When my mamas fight, they go on long car rides. Come back, and I hear our car stay still. They come in, and Robin goes directly to the bedroom angry. Maria will sometimes make toast, pour water. I sit in my room quiet, listening like a radio antenna. My mamas drive a CRV. They bought it brand new. The car is big-boned practical. It is our car. I have been one with this CRV for so long now. We used to drive for miles out on the highway until I fell asleep. It has taken me to martial arts practice and school plays. This is the car that drove me to the gay pride parade, where I skipped through the crowd throwing mini Oreos. This is the car I'll learn to drive in, the car I'll remember. Last Tuesday night, my mother Maria comes into the house with a weathered smile. My other mother, Robin, and I are sitting in the room. Maria asks us if we'll take a drive with her. So we all get in the car, our hearts thudding in offbeat unison. And as we drive, silence settles in. And I wonder, and then I know, this is it. And I didn't imagine it would end like this. I didn't imagine an ending at all, but if they were going to tell me about the divorce, what a way to do it. I sit in the back seat. I wonder when they'll say it, how they'll say it. I think about how my time will be split between them. I wonder what'll happen when they see each other afterwards. Will it feel like collisions? I don't want to meet a new girlfriend. I can't imagine anything but this. Its ending is unthinkable. My heart hurts at the thought of our last miles. These miles. Who will take the CRV? In the back seat, I think about how lucky we were to have had this family. Their 20 years of marriage, my 15 with them. I remember when Maria drove away one night without saying where. I remember when I came to them crying at the idea of separation. I remember when Robin came out sobbing. I remember when Maria whispers at Robin to be quiet and Robin yells louder. I feel these walls crumbling. I don't want this life to end. Maria starts to talk. I pinch my leg and look out the window. She tells me that our car, our CRV, is just 13 miles away from reaching 100,000 miles now. I wonder if this is part of the divorce speech or just a distraction. I feel angry. They should just say it. She tells me the reason we took this ride is so that we could all be there 100,000 miles together as the people who matter in her life. Slowly, I come to the realization that this isn't a breakup ride. This is a stay together ride. We're in the car and we're driving on a Tuesday night and we're 99,987 miles in. We stop for onion rings and sundaes, keep driving 99,993 miles, Stevie Nicks. 99,996 miles, Elton John. When we get to 99,999 miles, we hold hands, blast Melissa Etheridge, and sing Lucky at the top of our lungs. There are too many reasons that my mamas found love in each other's presence. There are too many moments when we are unbreakable. And in this moment, we are one family, constructing road as we go, burning bridges behind us, adding mileage like graceful aging, driving in our CRV towards moonlight.
Noah St. John.
I am not for sure.
And I'm not gonna lie. If that performance doesn't bring home the importance of snap storytelling, I'm out of bullets. Because you felt the same thing I felt. Before marriage was legal throughout the land, one boy's story galvanized and united people in a way that no policy paper or legal argument ever could. It changed things. And that's why I'm asking for your support today at snapjudgment.org. Because stories change things. It doesn't happen unless you support it. So support it at snapjudgment.org. I've only got until Friday the 13th before I go into a room and they ask me if snappers will step up to support the storytelling they love. I know the answer to that question. Yes, you will. Because that's what Snap Nation is all about. I feel this. I know this because you don't want a world where a 15-year-old boy doesn't tell that story. So pause the show. Pause it for just a moment. Go to snapjudgment.org. Show your support. $3, $3,000. Pick a gift that will help you tell your story. And let me go into that meeting with the power of Snap Nation at my back. Snapjudgment.org. Feels good, doesn't it? Feels like love and strawberries and warm hugs. Snapjudgment.org. Now, Jamie DeWolf had a mentor of his own. Jamie introduced me to this amazing man, Jack McCarthy. When I met Jack, he was sick. He knew he didn't have much time, but he also knew that he wanted to share his gift. Today on the Student and Teacher episode, we proudly present Jack McCarthy.
Oh, ladies and gentlemen, this is just getting started. We just had the youngest person ever on the Snap stage, and now we're about to go to the original gangster. Mr. Jack McCarthy is a legend in the performance storytelling circles. I cannot wait for you to hear him. I'm gonna get out of the way. Mr. Jack McCarthy.
Thank you for that introduction, Glenn. I don't mind being called original. But gangster might be a bit of a stretch. I was just old enough to be out on the sidewalk by myself. And every day, I would come home crying, beaten up by the same little girl. I was Jackie, the firstborn, the apple of every eye. Gratuitous meanness bewildered me, and as soon as she'd hit me, I'd bawl like a baby. I knew that boys were not supposed to cry, but they weren't supposed to hit girls either. And I was shocked when my father said, "Hit her back." I thought it was a great idea. But the only thing I remember about that girl today is the look that came over her face after I did hit her back. She didn't cry. Instead, her eyes got narrow, and I thought, "Jackie, you just made a terrible mistake." And she really beat the crap out of me. It was years before I trusted my father's advice again. I eventually learned to fight enough to protect myself from girls. But the real issue was the crying, and that hasn't gone away. Oh, I don't cry anymore, I don't sob, I don't make noise. I just have hair-triggered tear ducts, and always at all the wrong things. Tom Baudet saying, "We'll leave the light on for you." I always cried at the last scene of Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. In movies, I despise the easy manipulation that never even bothers to engage my feelings. It just comes straight from my eyes, but there's not a damn thing I can do about it, and I hate myself for it. The surreptitious nose blow, a discreet 4 minutes after the offending scene. My daughters are onto me, my wife, they all know exactly when to give me that quick sidelong glance. What must they think of me? In real life, I don't cry anymore when things hurt. Never a tear at 17 when my mother died, my father. I never cried for my first marriage. But today, I often cry when things turn out well. An unexpected act of simple human decency. New evidence against all odds of how much someone loves me. I think all this is why I never wanted a son. I always supposed my son would be like me, and that when he'd cry, it would bring back every indelible humiliation of my own life. And in some word or gesture, I'd betray what I was feeling, and he'd mistake and think I was ashamed of him. He'd carry that the rest of his life. I know. Daughters are easy. You can pick them up, you can hug them, you can say, "There, there, it's all right. Everything is going to be all right." And for that moment, you really believe that you can make enough of it right. Enough. The unskilled labor of love. And if you cry a little with them, for all the inevitable gratuitous meannesses of life, that crying is not to be ashamed of. But for years, my great fear was the moment I might have to deal with the crying son. but I don't have one. We came close once between Megan and Kathleen. The doctors told us there was something wrong. And when Joan went into labor, they said the baby would be born dead. But he wasn't. Very briefly, before he died, I heard him cry.
Hey there, this is Jamie DeWolf. I'm out performing on the road, but I wanted to take this moment to honor the memory of my mentor, teacher, and friend, the one and only Jack McCarthy. SNAP supports artists like Jack and Noah, and even people like myself. Keep us out here telling stories so that we can bring them back to you for your own road trips. Get back to SNAP at snapjudgment.org.
We've introduced three generations of influence from Jack to Jamie on the show today. And let's finish with the youngest member of the tribe, Noah St. John.
Ladies and gentlemen, rules were just broken. And we're going to have to break some more rules here today. We never have the same storyteller on twice, but I can't help myself. Mr. Noah St. John.
I practice capoeira. Capoeira is an Afro-Brazilian martial art form. In legend, it is said that it was created by African slaves to escape their Portuguese masters. Their hands were bound, so they relied on their feet. It was disguised as a dance with the jinga, the awus, but really, it is deadly. I'm in the capoeira circle, the hooda, and I'm about to play this kid named Dante that I've known since I was 3 years old. I met Dante upside down. Midway through a cartwheel, we locked eyes and he stuck his tongue out. Dante was a strong brown kid with a smile big as a mixing bowl. I was skinny with fishbowl eyes. I swear Dante did a backflip the first time he tried. I tried after him, but I landed on my back. Dante was always better than me at capoeira. Not just flips too, he would become a blur of arcs and kicks, controlled the space, was never short of breath. Dante and I grew up together in our capoeira hooda. And you have to understand that capoeira is a dance and a martial art and a game and a culture and a way of life. It was through capoeira that Dante and I became brothers. And the birimbau, stringed on a bow with a gourd, the lead instrument among many at the base of the hooda. The people in the circle sometimes clap and sing as it plays like chichidim-dom, 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 dim-dom, dim-dom, dim-dom. And that rhythm is Angola, which means Dante and I are supposed to play slow and low to the floor, but we don't always listen to what the birimbau tells us because we're young and we're fools, but we love it, so we're squatting. We shake hands and it's like, and Dante's over there just flipping and flipping, and I'm only jinga, armada e versa, macaco. Sometimes Dante comes in for an easy hasteda, sweeping me off my feet. He's always been better than me at capoeira. Sometimes I get jealous, but I know he just knows the moves better. He's been playing longer. He's bigger. I tell myself it's practice and size. The hooda ends. Dante and I get changed and walk outside. We walk past the pizza shop that used to be a different pizza shop that used to be a coffee house. past the beauty salon, past the cheesesteak, into the donut shop and out the back entrance. In the dim light, we see three figures. Two kids that look older than us and one smaller boy. The bigger ones have the little one pinned against the wall and he's crying. They're mumbling something to him. I get scared and freeze. Dante tenses. He calls out to them. Hey! They look at him serious, tell him to move on. Dante takes a breath and moves forward. They don't realize what's happening until it's too late. All I hear is the atabaki, the drum in my head playing steady. Boom, ba boom, ba boom, ba boom, ba boom, ba boom, ba boom. And Dante, in perfect rhythm, manlua, elbow, back fist, martello, I can almost see him flipping as he fights. And in that moment, I realize why Dante has always been better than me at capoeira. The next week in the Huda, capoeira is different. The first time I sang was when my voice found its feet and stumbled out a capoeira song like... Oi, sim, 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 oi, now, 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 oi, sim. Oi now, now, now. Oi, sim, sim, sim. Oi now, now, now. Oi, sim, sim, sim. Oi now, now, now. And the first time I moved was when my body felt the rhythm. And the first time I danced was when I heard the music. And the first time I fought was when I knew I was fighting. And the first time first time, we are in the same game.
Snap. It happened again. You felt it again. You are at the end of a Snap Judgment episode. Think about that. Think about it long and hard. Are these the stories you're going to contemplate, share with your partner, talk about? Do you own a piece of this show? It's your thing. There's no question. It's me and you together at the end of another program. We know this. Nobody else. Me and you. So I am asking. Please support the storytelling you love right now. SnapJudgment.org.